Tonight's reading will come from John chapter 4, verses 27 through 30. And I'll be reading from the English Standard Version. Just then, his disciples came, and they marveled that he was talking with a woman. No one said, "What do you seek? And why are you talking with her? So the woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, 'Come, see, who told me all that I had ever done. And can this be the Christ?' And they went out of the city of the town, and they were coming to him."
In our study this morning, we talked about the power of an invitation and how important that is. We looked at a number of illustrations of that in our study this morning, and I want to use some of those in our study this evening to offer the Lord's invitation. Now, in our study this morning, we looked at John chapter 1, as has been pointed out to us already. And we noted in John chapter 1 that some of the disciples came to Jesus, and their question was, "Where do you abide?" or "Where abidest thou?" And Jesus said, "Come and see." And he took them with him, and he spent the day with them. And no doubt they learned a great deal sitting at the feet of Jesus. We talked in our study this morning also how that Andrew saw his brother Peter having identified Jesus, and he said, "Come and see, we found the Messiah." Same thing with Philip, how that he found Nathanael. And we looked at a number of such illustrations. In our study this morning, we were focusing somewhat of our attention on this text of John chapter 4, this Samaritan woman. How that this Samaritan woman has had a conversation with the Lord, how that Jesus asked her for a drink of water, and she injected into the discussion the prejudice that had characterized the relationship between the Jews and the Samaritans for a lot of years. She said, "Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Well, that had been traditionally so. She said, "How askest thou me a drink of water?" Well, we learned that from that prejudice kind of beginning, the fuss that the woman had introduced, that Jesus, from that point, he did not engage in that kind of discussion. But from that discussion, he engaged her in a discussion of spiritual things. And he taught her about God and how to worship God and who God is, and that God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And in that context, Jesus told her to go bring your husband. She said, "I have no husband." He said, "You've spoken rightly. You have no husband. Fact is, you've had five husbands, and the man that you have now is not your husband. Thou hast truly spoken." Now, when the woman had learned some things from Jesus, she went into the city, and she began to tell the others that, "I have found somebody that's told me everything that I ever did. He must be a prophet. Come and see." And so they went out, and they saw, and they said, "We first believed based upon the things that you said, but now we've heard and seen for ourselves, and so we believe on the basis of the things that we've seen and heard." Now, that just kind of summarizes John chapter 4. It helps us to see the point of this expression, "Come and see." We talked about it, as we mentioned, quite at length in our study this morning. We noted that in Revelation 22, the Spirit and the Bride say, "Come. He that is athirst, let him come." And so it's an invitation, and we talked about the importance of that. And we extend that tonight, just as Jesus did in Matthew 11, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest in your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now let me ask you, brethren, when you're talking to somebody about the gospel and talking with them about spiritual things, isn't that your desire? You want to invite their attention to spiritual things. You invite them to concern themselves with spiritual things. And that's what we want to do. That's what we want to do tonight. We noted that when the Apostle Paul went into the city of Thessalonica in Acts the 17th chapter, they were not very receptive. He went into the Jewish synagogue and he opened from the Scriptures and alleged that it behooved the Christ to suffer and to die and on the third day be raised from the dead according to the Scriptures. And we note that they rejected what he said and essentially ran him out of town. But dropping on down in that text to Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 11, we read about those in Berea, how that they were more noble than those in Thessalonica, that they searched the Scriptures daily to find out whether or not the things they were being taught were true. Now, isn't that what we invite you to do? Isn't that what you want to do? And isn't that what you want to invite somebody else to do? Well, that's right. And the reason is you do not want their confidence to be necessarily in you. You want their confidence to be in what the Scriptures teach, their confidence to be in the Lord. So you invite questions. You invite folks to investigate. Come, find out. Come and see. Now, in our brief moments tonight, I want to talk with you about three things that we need to investigate, things that we need to find out. This woman did not know who God is. I find that remarkable. We know in the text in John chapter 4 that Jesus said that you worship in this mountain. And, of course, the Jews worship in Jerusalem. As we notice in this context, in verse 21, the context begins. I'm sorry, verse 20. The woman said, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said unto her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall ye worship God, or shall ye worship the Father. Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews." Now, an interesting statement there. You worship that which you know not. We've studied about the history of the Samaritans for a long time. And we note in 2 Kings chapter 17 that as a result of the king of Assyria conquering the northern 10 tribes and bringing the captives into the northern area of the land of Palestine, those who were captives from other nations, mixing them up, they complained that the lions are eating us. And so the king sent one of the prophets, or one of the priests rather, that had been taken captive of the Jews back to educate them about the God of this land. Now the results of that effort is seen in the latter part of that context where the people continued to worship their idols. They just added one to it. They worship God now. Now what really did that prophet, or did that priest rather, know about God? You see, the prophets and the priests were responsible for educating the people of Israel about God, and they had been engaged in idolatry. So what did they know about God? Here's a woman that's speaking to the Messiah. Jesus identifies himself to her in John chapter 4. She knew that there is one coming that would be called the Messiah, and Jesus said, "I that speak unto thee am he." That's who I am. I am the Messiah. Now we note that this woman needed to understand that. She had not understood that before. When we are teaching somebody about the gospel, their obedience to the gospel, their need for the gospel, we need to present to them who Jesus is. Come and see who he is. Now how would you begin to tell somebody about who Jesus is? Would not you say something to them about how much he loves us? To the extent that he left the glory of heaven, Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 5, to live in the flesh of a man, subjecting himself to the will of God, even unto death. Would you not suggest that those are things they need to think about when considering who he is? He is God, and he loves those who are lost. John chapter 15, and in verse 13, Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends." That's what Jesus did. We know that God so loved the world that he sent his Son, John chapter 3 and verse 16. When we talk about who Jesus is, we need to identify his love for those who are lost. We also need to identify his love for those who are even his enemies. You remember as the crowd shouted out when Pilate said, "What shall we do with this Jesus who is called Christ?" They said, "Crucify him, crucify him." The text of Matthew and Luke tell us the angry mob shouted jeers at him. They spit at him. But yet as Jesus was about to die in such a cruel way, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." They don't understand. Yes, they knew that they were putting somebody to death. And they, as were pointed out to us in the remarks around the table this morning about what crucifixion entails, they knew they were doing that. They understood all about that. But they didn't understand the significance of what they were doing. "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Jesus prayed for those who were his enemies, for those who are lost. When you're telling somebody about who Jesus is, don't you want to tell them about his life? About how that he died, and about how that he was raised from the dead. There's a remarkable statement that's made in Matthew's account of the resurrection in Matthew chapter 28. As some come, and they're evidently looking at the tomb of Jesus. And in verse 5, an angel answered and said unto the woman, "Fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus, who hath been crucified. He is not here, for he is risen, even as he said, come see the place where the Lord lay." And here is another statement. Come and see. Well, what did they need to come and see? That he yet lives. He was raised from the dead. His body was no longer in the tomb. Now, when you're telling folks about who Jesus is, isn't that what you're inviting them to recognize? Who he is, that he loves you, and that he died for you, but that he was raised from the dead. Now, how did he live? Hebrews chapter 4 tells us, beginning in verse 14, that we have not a high priest that cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one that hath been tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. That's who he is. That's how he lived his life. He never committed one sin. He knows what you're suffering. He knows what temptation is. Tempted in all points, like as you are. And my friend, when he suffered on the cross, when he died, and when he was raised from the dead, we want to read this text in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 18. For in chapter 1, we see Jesus identified essentially as the author of the book of Revelation. Sometimes we want to identify that John is the author. John's the one that wrote it down. But it came from the Lord. And you'll see that in verse 18. As Jesus said, "I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and of Hades." And my friend, when you're talking with somebody that's not a Christian, and you're trying to invite them to obey the gospel, you want them to see who Jesus is. The authority that he holds as he holds the keys of death and Hades. How that he can provide for you life and victory over Satan. Now, when we're talking to somebody who's not a Christian, and we, as the numerous texts that we've identified, come and see. Come and see what? Well, certainly we want somebody to understand the love that Jesus has. We want somebody to understand the life that he lived. We want somebody to understand the victory that he gained after death as he was raised from the dead. But friend, don't we want to see, or want them to see, what he did for us? Now, sometimes when we're studying about these things, we read rather extensively from Isaiah chapter 53. And I want you to look at that briefly with us in our study this evening. Isaiah chapter 53. In the text, the prophet said, "Who hath believed our message? And to whom hath the arm of Jehovah been revealed? For he grew up before him as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we see him there is no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we esteemed him not." Now, do we know who Isaiah is talking about? Well, certainly we do. As we continue to read, beginning in verse 4. The writer says, "Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And Jehovah hath laid on him the iniquity of us all." You keep reading in this text, you see that the prophet Isaiah is talking about the coming of Jesus and how that he would die on the cross, how that he would bear the iniquities of those for whom he died. But in doing that, we want to note that the justice of God was satisfied, a very critical point. In Isaiah chapter 53, as you pick up the text in verse 10, it says, "Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities." Now, when you read Isaiah chapter 53, you want to see the crucifixion of Jesus. You want to see why he died. He died because of sin. Sin is a horrible thing. When you think of who God is and who Jesus is, the Son of the living God came to die for sin that he did not commit, but rather for sin that we've committed. And you can sign your name right underneath that. Sin that you've committed. And perhaps you can begin to enumerate in your own mind the things that you know you've done that cost Jesus His life. That's what He died for. So that you might be justified. Do you see that? Look at it carefully once again in the context that we just read. In verse 11. And he shall see of his the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied by the knowledge of himself. Shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Justify. That's what Jesus came to do. And as you turn in your New Testament, you see that word stated a number of times. And in reference to his sacrifice, the Apostle Paul writing said, beginning in Romans chapter 3, verse 23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith in His blood, to show His righteousness because of the passing over of the sins done aforetime in the forbearance of God, for the showing, I say, of His righteousness at this present season, that He might Himself be just and the justifier of him that hath faith in Jesus. Now look carefully at that passage. We often look at this and we read verse 23, that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We've committed that to memory. We understand the significance of that. But yet sometimes when we're reading verse 26, we miss the point. The writer has identified that God sent His Son to be a propitiation, that is, a sin offering, that what might occur? That God might be righteous. Now, how is it that God is righteous in sending His Son? You know, when we think about the penalty of sin being executed, the penalty being death, how then can you commit sin and be allowed to go free? How can that be possible? And you see, that's the dilemma. But it wasn't a dilemma to God. It was a part of God's eternal plan to save your soul. That God might be just, He sent His Son to live a perfect life without sin, being tempted just like you are, so that He could be the perfect, the adequate sacrifice to take away your sin. Now we see in that the sacrifice that He made. But again, the question is why? Well, we say His blood had to be shed in order that His blood might take away our sin. Well, that's right. His blood was shed that God might be just. And you think about that element. We don't talk about that much. The justice of God demanded something. It demanded that sin is not just swept under the carpet and pretend you didn't do it. The penalty of sin had to be borne by somebody. And God sent His Son to do that. Now that's what the prophet Isaiah is saying when he said that God looked upon this and He was satisfied. The justice of God was upheld. The righteousness of God is displayed. But that He also might be the justifier. Now that's interesting to me because justify is a legal term that indicates acquittal or allows you to go free. Well, if Jesus died for everybody, then why doesn't everybody go free? Well, some would conclude that, but the text of Romans 3 doesn't say that. The text of Romans 3 tells us that He is the justifier of him that hath faith in Jesus. Not everybody does that. Not everybody's willing to obey Him. And so, if you're trying to help somebody to come and see, you want them to see what Jesus did. Why the sacrifice of His blood was necessary. You see, there would be no forgiveness without it. We often quote Romans chapter 6, verses 3 and 4. As we talk about the need to be baptized. And in that text it says, or are ye ignorant that all we who were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into His death? We were buried therefore with Him through baptism into death, that like as Christ was raised from the dead through the glory of the Father, so we also might walk in newness of life. Now friend, you look at your Bible. When does this new life come? Before or after one is baptized? Well, the text tells us that one is raised to walk a new life. Raised from what? Raised from being baptized. You see, in the same way that Jesus was crucified, buried, and raised from the dead, in that same way, you die to the old life. The old man is buried in baptism and raised to walk a new life. When does the new life come? Well, it's after one has been baptized into Christ. Because it is there that one comes in contact with the blood of Christ that can wash away his sins. Isn't that simple? You want somebody to come and see, to see that. Well, that's not hard to see, is it? When you invite somebody to obey the Lord, to come and see, you want them to understand what the church is. Now you see, we've introduced three very simple points that each one of them could be a whole series of lessons. We're not going to do that because we're just simply offering the Lord's invitation. It's a great opportunity. But here's what we want somebody to see. See what the church is. Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church." It's the body of saved people. It's described as this holy priesthood, as you can see in 1 Peter chapter 2 in verses 4 and 5. These are the people of God, those who are redeemed by the blood of Christ. That's what the church is. The Apostle Peter further defines that in 2 Peter chapter 2 in verse 9 and 10 as those who have been called by the power of His calling. Called out of darkness, Paul said in Colossians 1, verse 13 or 12 and 13, into His marvelous light. Called to be sanctified, a holy people, the church. All the text of Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 22. He says, "Wives, be in subjection to your husbands, as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, being Himself the Savior of the body." You see what the church is? It's that body of saved people. Now, when you're trying to get somebody to come and see, you want them to see what the church is, so they can be a part of it. This body of sanctified, holy, saved people. And what does that mean to you? Maybe you're talking to somebody who has obeyed the gospel, but they're not being faithful to the Lord. You need to see what the instruction is, even to the people of God. In Hebrews chapter 3, here the letter is addressed to Hebrews who have become Christians, and they're about to leave it and go back to the way they were. And the writer tells them in verse 6, Hebrews chapter 3, and in verse 6, "But Christ has a Son over His house, whose house are we if we hold fast our boldness and the glorying of our hope, firm unto the end." Hold fast. You see, maybe we need to hold fast to that which we have. Well, what does that imply that we have? We have something that's valuable, folks. We have a crown. Now, a crown indicates victory. Look, if you will, in your text of Romans, or Revelation it is, chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3, there beginning in verse 10, to the church in Philadelphia, the writer says, "Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I also will keep thee from the hour of trial, that hour which is come upon the whole world to try them that dwell upon the earth. I come quickly. Hold fast that which thou hast, that no one take thy crown." Be faithful. Also, you'll notice in Revelation 2 and in verse 10, the writer said, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life." Now, my friend, come and see. That's what we want people to do, to come and see. Well, come and see what ultimately? To come and see how the triumph can be yours. In the book of Revelation, written to those who are very troubled because of the persecution that is imposed upon them because of their faith, the text tells us that they seem, now this is the vision, Revelation 4 and 5, the revelation of the throne room of God. And in chapter 5, the Lamb is being honored by those round about the throne. And the writer tells us, and they sing a new song, saying, "Worthy art thou to take the book and open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and didst purchase unto God with thy blood men of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and madest them to be unto our God a kingdom and priests, and they reign upon the earth." Well, marvelous thought that is presented picture of triumph, victory. That could be yours. If you're not a Christian, we want you to see that. See what can be yours. See who Christ is. See what He's done for us. See what you can be a part of. And if you've done that and you've not lived faithfully, my friend, you need to take another look at these things. Come and see. Don't give up your crown. See the triumph that Christ has gained for you over victory, over death and Hades, that you might receive the crown. You listen kindly. Perhaps I'm talking to somebody who needs to respond. Would you do that this evening? The invitation is yours. If we can help you by praying with you and for you, or by assisting you in being baptized into Christ, that's our desire. Make that known while together we stand and while we sing this song.